Welcome to this special Fifth Wednesday Halloween edition of Forthright Radio, October 31st, 2012. I'm Joy LeClaire, and do we ever have a full show for you today. We'll be speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnson. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Among his other books are Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Also, Perfectly Legal, the Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. And his first book, Temples of Chance, How America Inc. Bought Out Murder Inc. to Win Control of the Casino Business, which is an account of how the junk bond kings usurped mob control of the casino industry in the 1980s. The book discusses corruption in the industry and the role of the federal and state governments in that corruption. And it's particularly pertinent this election cycle, with gambling tycoon Sheldon Adelson and his wife contributing more than $70 million to defeat President Barack Obama, and having vowed to spend up to $100 million to do so. David K. Johnson, after a distinguished career at such journals as the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the LA Times, where he investigated Los Angeles Police Department political spying and other abuses, misuse of charitable funds at United Way, and where he once hunted down a killer whom the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department had failed to catch, resulting in an innocent man winning acquittal at his fifth trial. Well, since 2009, David K. Johnson has been a distinguished visiting lecturer at Syracuse University's College of Law and Whitman School of Management, where he teaches the tax, property, and regulatory law of the ancient world. In July of 2011, he became a columnist for Reuters, writing and producing video commentaries on worldwide issues of tax, accounting, economics, public finance, and business. We welcome you to Forthright Radio, David K. Johnson.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Joy. Just one little bookkeeping note. I left Reuters a month ago, so I'm...
Oh, you did. I tried to verify that, and I couldn't. Well, now you have.
Yeah.
But as you put in your acknowledgments, your role at Reuters had nothing to do with the writing, researching and writing of your latest book, which we'll be focusing on today, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind.
Correct.
Well, you asked the question early on in your book, how have all us consumers ended up paying so many extra charges on electric, phone, and other bills? And I think of supreme interest to our listeners in Mendocino County. And I must add, you actually at one time lived in Mendocino County, didn't you, David?
Yeah, a long time ago, in 1960, lived in Ukiah.
Yeah, you were, a fifth grader then?
Fifth grader, yep.
Okay, well, so anyway, you're somewhat familiar with the area. The thing that many people in Mendocino County are still struggling with is lack of proper Internet speed.
Yeah.
Many of our listeners are still on dial-up, which is just devastating in this modern world. Give us some idea how this sort of happened. And before you do that, let me fill you in a little pertinent history. I was married at one time to the 5th District Planning Commissioner, Don Lipmanson, and in the 1990s, some of these multinational corporations requested permission to tear up Mendocino County roads to lay down the fiber optics, which they did. They were granted permission. Don Lipmanson was the sole voice on the Planning Commission, not to prevent it, but to insist that county citizens get something in return other than the promise that the roads would be returned to their original condition, which many may argue didn't happen. he tried to explain that we had to get out of the mentality of being a third world colonial entity here in Mendocino County, and that our citizens be given access to the internet. Well, he was voted down, and to this day, many of our listeners do not have adequate internet access. So give us some history about how that happened, and I've heard you say that actually in the original licenses granted way back in the 1920s or whatever for phones, everyone was supposed to have access. So take it from there, David K. Johnson.
Yes, let me walk through this. This is a very important development. I believe that the single biggest thing holding back economic growth in the United States is what we have done with our internet. America invented the internet. Therefore, by definition, we started out number one. We are now 29th in the world and falling in the speed of our internet. We are behind such advanced countries as Bulgaria, Ukraine, Lithuania, and Latvia in our internet. And we pay some of the highest prices in the world for the internet that we do have and the very limited areas that high-speed internet serves. Now, if you live in France, and I don't mean living in Paris or Marseille, if you live in Meaux in the middle of the country, you can get a triple play package of the kind you see advertised all the time on television, and you will get, just as in America, cable, internet, and telephone. In America, on average, with taxes, you pay $160 a month for a triple play package. In France, you pay the equivalent of $38 American, less than one-fourth as much. And for that much, much smaller fee, you don't get just domestic television. You get worldwide live television. You don't get just two-country calling like we do, U.S. and Canada. You get free long distance to 70 countries and virtually free everywhere else. And your internet is 10 times faster. If you live in Korea, everybody has high-speed internet. If you live in Japan, everybody has high-speed, enormous capacity internet. And when I, in the last two summers, was reporting in Singapore, Macau, Hong Kong, South Korea, Japan, all of these places, their internet, their cell phone service was dramatically superior to ours and yet not nearly as expensive. So how did this come about? How do we end up paying more than four times what the French pay for not nearly so good services and having vast areas of the United States that do not have internet access except at the dial-up speeds of 20 years ago? Well, we had a telephone monopoly in this country, AT&T. It was expensive. When I was a boy, my mother used to keep, and my father, a little sand dial next to the phone to make sure they didn't go past 3 minutes, because you had to pay for 3 minutes on a long-distance call, and then if you went 1 second over, you had to pay for a whole additional minute. Lots of people had these. In 1913, the Justice Department announced that it was going to break up the AT&T monopoly so there would be competition, which would lead to lower prices, and AT&T made a deal. It's called the Kingsbury Commitment, and the deal they made was to promise, A, to stop buying up little mom-and-pop phone companies, and there are hundreds of them around the country, and secondly, to provide everyone access to their long-distance system instead of cutting out these mom-and-pop and smaller companies, and thirdly, guaranteed service at any address. Now, if you live in the middle of the forest without an address, they don't have to serve you. But if you have a street address and you say, I want a telephone, the phone company is required to provide you with phone service. You have to pay for it, but they must serve you. In 1970, so that ended the effort to break up AT&T. In 1974, the Justice Department announced during the Nixon era that they were going to break up the telephone monopoly. And everybody was told in 1974 that we would get lower prices through competition. 10 years later, they broke up Ma Bell into Ma Bell, the long-distance company, and the seven Baby Bells, which have now been reduced to two, plus one that doesn't really significant because it's so small, and that's the one serving the Rocky Mountain and Great Plains states, plus Oregon and Washington. So AT&T and Verizon are now the telephone duopoly in America. They have over 70% of the business. And they don't compete. in the landline business and the internet business, they have separate geographic monopolies. So we don't have competition that we were promised. And this is a lot of what the fine print is about, I show how, and this is just one example of this, corporations have quietly been going to Sacramento and Albany and the other state capitals and to Washington, and they are getting the laws of competition repealed. Because if there's anything business people don't want, Joy, it's competition. They want to avoid competition. That way they can invest less in the business, artificially inflate prices, provide shoddy goods and services, and yet earn enormous profits. The only company in America of any size that offers internet service directly to your home with glass fiber is Verizon. They are only building a system that will reach 16 million households. But because of these new laws, they could literally say to you, you could be living on a street where Verizon has glass fiber running right in front of your house or apartment building, and they can say, no, we're not going to serve you. They don't have to say why. They don't have to give any explanation. We're just not going to serve you. And the proof that of this matter is what happened in New Jersey. In New Jersey, there's an apartment building whose owners in North Jersey have taken great pains to keep it lovely and beautiful. It's an older building. And so they said to Verizon, well, listen, before you wire us for fiber optic, we'd like to go over the wiring plans with you so you don't do any unnecessary damage to the building. We can figure out how to do this the least harmful way to the building. And Verizon said, I'm sorry, we don't negotiate. We punch holes where we want to. Take it or leave it. That was almost 5 years ago. And who lives in this particular building? The chief ratepayer advocate for the state of New Jersey, the assistant attorney general whose job is to look out for ratepayers. Now, if she can't get service, even after I wrote about this when I was a columnist at Reuters, and I thought, well, some Verizon executive will read this and say, whatever else, let's not be stupid and let's not have an unnecessary problem with this particular person. Let's go wire the building. Nope, that's how arrogant they've become. Five states have so far repealed your legal right to a telephone. Florida, Alabama, Texas, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. Not a single news report in any of those states about this. When I call people who are advocates for the poor, for people who get lifeline service, who are disabled or very poor or elderly, and who are involved in utility issues in three of those five states, they were unaware that this law had been repealed. And that goes to the heart of what I'm doing in the fine print. I'm telling you what the mainstream news media, where I spent 40-some years working, has failed to report. And it is how big business in America is rewriting the laws of competition and the laws of commerce to take away your rights, to eliminate or block competition, to raise prices, to make them rich at your expense, and to make sure you have no idea what they're doing.
In addition to what you've just said, there is also the, I find, unbelievably shocking situation which you introduce with the history of Bruce Kushnick,
yeah,
who had the ability to look at his aunt's 20 years' worth of phone bills and to compare the evolution from 1984 to 2003. Take a little time and talk about what he discovered in that process,
which I think all of
us are discovering, actually, without realizing it.
Bruce Kushnick was a consultant to the telephone industry, and he was being paid very good money to go out and sell people on how the wonderful new telephone industry was going to be. And then, you know, like Saul on the road to Damascus, he was struck by lightning and had this epiphany. In his case, he went to visit his aunt in Brooklyn. She had no long-distance service. She had a rotary telephone. She didn't even have digital service, you know, push-button telephone or touch-tone service. And she was being charged for all sorts of things that her phone couldn't, her two phones couldn't even use. Two extensions, not two separate lines. And between, I think it's 1982 and 2002, the years that she had kept every single phone bill so Bruce could go through them, her basic local telephone costs rose at well more than twice the rate of inflation. And one of the things Bruce became intrigued with is, if you look at your phone bill, there will be a line on it that says some variation of the following: FCC charge, FCC subscription charge, FCC line charge. Now, that sounds like the Federal Communications Commission is imposing some fee. You're being hit, in addition to taxes, with a government fee. And it's a pretty fat fee. The fee typically in every phone bill I've seen in the last year has been $6.50 a month. Well, in fact, the government doesn't get any of that money. All of that money goes to the telephone company. The FCC simply approves that charge. And what is the charge? It's the price that you pay to be connected to the long-distance network. So just as if you look at your electric bill, there's a charge on it just for being connected to the electric system. Or if you live in an area where you have natural gas instead of propane, there'll be a monthly charge just to be connected to the system. That's what this is. This is just the charge to connect from your local phone to the long-distance calling network, whether or not you make any long-distance calls. Now, the FCC has something called truth in billing rules, and these government regulations say all telephone bills must be understandable to ordinary people. So Bruce Kushnick commissioned a survey of 1,000 Americans to see if they understood their phone bill. Exactly three of them did. 99.7% did not, which means that if you round, 100% of Americans don't understand their phone bill, despite the FCC truth in billing rules. And this is a good example of how business has captured, how corporations have captured the government regulators and put them to work on their behest. And, Joy, one of the things I want to make clear about this, and I'm glad you mentioned Bruce, because the same chapter also tells about a movie executive, the guy who was behind Dead Poets Society and March of the Penguins and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, who went out to start his own film company and went to AT&T for money 10 years ago, and they gave him everything he wanted. But what he was fascinated by was that they told him that their plan was to triple the amount of money every customer was paying them and do it within 10 years. And, in fact, his phone bill has gone up sixfold during those years to AT&T. All of this book is told through the stories of people. This is not a textbook. I'm not sitting here and reading, saying, I'll read this regulation. It's like going to some advanced college class. This is all told through the stories of individual people and how those people were affected. People who, their house nearly burned down because utility companies are stripping away the money they spent on maintenance and repair. On how the San Bruno explosion, that terrible natural gas explosion 2 years ago, is one of a number of explosions that tell us that these pipelines laid when Truman or Eisenhower was in the White House need to be replaced. And who got killed in the San Bruno explosion? Well, among the dead was the California Public Utilities Commission investigator whose assignment was to find out, are the pipelines safe or are they a threat to life?
Yes, well, that does bring up the whole pipeline thing. And in addition to the deaths that you report, and we actually did a whole show about a month ago about the pipeline that Canadian tar sands I don't necessarily hope that. Let's talk about the realities of these pipelines, how very dangerous they are, and also how very lucrative they are. I certainly had no idea how these things
After I finished my book, the new Forbes 400 list came out, and it turns out three of the top 100 people on that list are heiresses of pipelines. What is a pipeline? It is a government monopoly with a right-of-way to bury this thing in the ground. Now, we need pipelines. They are the most efficient way to move things around. And like it or not, at this stage of human development, we're going to burn fossil fuels. Natural gas is the best of the fossil fuels we're going to have. But there's no reason that pipelines should be operated in a dangerous manner. When these pipelines were built, they typically had a safety factor of 1.4. That meant they had 40% more strength in the steel than the maximum pressure they were designed to take. And by the way, these big pipelines, some of them are 30, 48 inches across, and they operate at 1,500 pounds of pressure per square inch when they're new. Now, they try to dry out the natural gas they ship in these pipelines, but the fact is they don't always get it. So wherever there's a low spot, moisture tends to collect and corrode the wall of the pipeline. And, of course, no matter what, the pipeline wall will, over time, corrode. So these pipelines should be replaced. And one of the stories I tell is about this extended family that was camping on a, they were on a trip, and they pulled over in the desert in New Mexico in 1999 to go camping. And they're sound asleep in the middle of the night when the major pipeline, the El Paso Natural Gas Pipeline that feeds California, exploded. There were windows rattled 20 and 30 miles away. When the firefighters got there, it was so loud, this gigantic pipeline and torch with flames hundreds of feet in the air, the firefighters literally had to shout into each other's ears, cup hands around ears, and shout instructions. When they finally turned off the pipeline, it took more than an hour. There was this momentary silence, and then as soon as everybody's ears adjusted, they heard this terrible wailing, and they run down to the Pecos River, and six of these people are burned. One of them is begging to be shot, and they all die within a couple of days. What is the news coverage of this horrible incident that tells us something? Electricity prices are going up in California because of an explosion that damaged the natural gas pipeline. That's with the news coverage. Everywhere but locally. And not, hey, why did this pipeline explode? It turns out there was no training in safety of any decent amount for the people running it. They hadn't inspected the pipeline, and they had relied on estimates by engineers of the pipeline's ability to operate under high pressure. And guess what? The engineers got it wrong. Very significantly in the case of the deaths of those people, there is a federal standard on pipeline explosions that says that a pipeline of this kind should create a what I call a zone of certain death 660 feet across from the point of the explosion. This pipeline was operating less than half that level of pressure. These people were camping 675 feet away, so they were outside the zone for maximum pressure, and yet they were all burned to death. Every year, there are school principals and hospital administrators who get a notice from the pipeline industry. It's a wonderful little brochure all about the wonderful things the pipeline industry does. And if you got one in the mail, Joy, I think you would look at it and go, what do I care about this for, and throw it in the trash. But if you sit down and read the fine print, when you get to page 5, you will read, you are receiving this because you are the principal or hospital administrator or whatever who operates a facility that is in a high-consequence area. And then it would go on without telling you anything useful. High-consequence area is the euphemism that the industry got the government to officially adopt for zone of certain death. So there are schools that have aging pipelines running right down the street in front of them, or in some cases right under them. In San Bruno, the pipeline that was laid in 1957 was laid through an open field that was later covered with houses and other developments, and the city fire department didn't even know it was there. Only after the explosion did the mayor and the fire department find out there was a second pipeline running through San Bruno because it ran underneath a tot lot. And they were going to put a building on this little tot lot where mothers take their kids every day and fathers take their kids every day, and they discovered this pipeline underneath. Pipelines that are 60 years old, they need to be replaced. But the companies, that costs money. So what do? They get rules adopted to let them keep operating the pipelines. And the result is you're put at risk of being horribly burned to death so they can profit. There was no inspection of pipelines at all until 10 years ago. And now the government gives out what they call special permits. I call them safety waivers. These are permits that say you don't have to inspect the pipeline, even though the federal law says so, because it's not practical to inspect it. Some of these say you don't even have to do a surface inspection looking for leaks that are coming up through the ground, which you can find because it kills plant life, for 7 years. So I asked both the operator of one pipeline in western New York, where I live, and the federal government, well, where exactly is this segment, particular segment of pipeline, because they use a proprietary system to describe it. And they said, we can't tell you that, because if terrorists got a hold of this, they might blow up the pipeline. Now, no self-respecting terrorist is going to blow up a pipeline in Mendocino County or where I live in the Finger Lakes area of western New York. That's crazy. You're going to blow one up, you're going to do it in New York, San Francisco, Chicago, where it would have maximum impact and maximum news coverage. But that's their position. They won't tell you. And by the way, here's the other thing that they didn't know. When I read the inspection permit, it seemed to say that you could operate the pipeline when 80% of the wall is corroded. They mean...
Say that 20... again, David. Yeah. Say that again. That's
the way the permit is worded...
not 18.
No, 80. I read these permits, and I said, you know, this sounds like you can operate this pipeline in some places where it's 80% worn through, and in other places 72% worn through. Now, what they really mean is 20% worn through and 28% worn through. So there'd be 80 or 70% left. But the way it's worded, that's what it says. So I sent this to a copy editor, one of the best copy editors that I know, and said, what does this say? And she diagrammed the sentence and said, you can operate this pipeline when it's 80% worn through. I sent this to one of the most eminent engineering professors on pipeline safety in America, and he called me back and said, oh, David, the government's full of this stuff. When I work on nuclear safety and nuclear power plants, there are all sorts of permits where they mean to say 20%, but they say the opposite, 80, because they didn't word them correctly. So, being a good citizen, I called up both the federal government, the Office of Pipeline Safety, and the company that owned the pipeline. And they were both like, we don't understand what you're talking about. There's no problem here. And I said to them, well, tell you what, and it's in my book, if this pipeline happens to explode someday, I'm sure that my book will turn into a full employment act for the lawyers who are going to sue you people because you were told about a danger and you did nothing about it. But the callousness of business in America that has arisen with the starting with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 is just incredible. And the attitude of business, that the purpose of business is solely to make money, which is, by the way, not what the law says is the duty of a corporation's board of directors at all, unless they're kicking out the public shareholders, permeates what's going on. And as a result, we are getting a society totally and completely run by corporate values. The first corporations in the world started out with the Romans. They were proto-corporations. And their purpose was to serve the interests of the state. Today, the state exists to serve the corporations. And your liberties, your economics, are being damaged by these rules and laws that I describe in the fine print that the news media has never written about.
Let's take a moment to reintroduce our guest is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We're talking about the shocking findings in his latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. I'm Joy LeClaire, and the name of the show is Forthright Radio. It's hopeless to try to do any kind of broad coverage of everything you have in this book, David K. Johnston.
I agree. There's 26 chapters of this stuff. I agree.
Yeah, so I'm going to focus on what I think will be of most interest to our listeners. You show time after time, instance after instance, where regulations have been altered so that corporations can reduce their number of staff, they can collect fees and taxes that are supposedly going to the government, but that they are by law allowed to keep.
Yep.
Let's talk about the aging infrastructure and the declining number of utility workers, particularly pertinent, I think, with Hurricane Sandy and the millions of households that are without power.
Joy, the utility companies, which are legal monopolies, used to operate on an economic model that the more they spent taking care of the system, the bigger their profits were. We now have a model that allows them to strip these assets. So you stop taking care of maintaining the equipment. You save a lot of money that way. You stop replacing power poles. PG&E got rate increases. You know, your PG&E customer, you know they've gotten rate increase after rate increase now for a decade. They, by their own sworn testimony, should replace 46,000 poles a year. The average PG&E pole is 41 years old, and its average life, they say, is 50 years. So they're supposed to replace half of their poles, more than a million poles, in the next 9 years. They're currently replacing poles at a rate that will not do the job until 2,779. They're only replacing 3,000 poles a year. That's putting not only the reliability of your electric service at risk, it's putting your life at risk. One of the stories I tell is about some people who came home up near Reno, and there was arcing in a box outside their home, and they were told not to worry about it. The next morning when the lineman came he told them that they were lucky it didn't catch fire. Well, they live in a cul-de-sac on the high desert at the end of one road out, and that suddenly they realized that had this caught fire during the night, everybody in this subdivision of hundreds of homes could have been burned to death. They could have been trapped in the area. And all over the country this is going on, Joy. They are cutting staff and cutting staff and cutting staff. Where I live in western New York, we had almost no effect from the hurricane, Sandy. Mm-hmm. And yet 10,000 people have been without power here for a day and a half, and they say it'll be another day till they restore them. Why? Because they don't have enough people, and because when they went in to restore the power, they had to replace all this equipment they were taking care of. And what that means, by the way, is in the future there will be huge rate increases sought by PG&E to when they come in and say, we have an emergency. We have to replace all these power poles. We're having collapsing power poles. We need a huge rate increase today. And if they're lucky, they'll get to keep it forever. So
let's give some examples. For one thing, you talk about holding companies and how deregulation has allowed vertically integrated monopolies, how laws were repealed that allow that. Explain what the problem with holding companies is.
Sure.
And are, and
all
why
of the
you
legal,
feel it needs to be changed.
Sure. All of the legal monopolies in America, railroads, pipelines, electric utilities, gas utilities, telephone utilities, water utilities, cable TV, these are all legal monopolies. In some places, technically, they're not legal monopolies, but they're economic monopolies, are almost all controlled by a company above them called a holding company. So when they get the rates set by the government, those rates assume that the holding that the company you're paying your bill to, PG&E, Time Warner Cable, AT&T Telephone, is paying in full each year the income taxes they earn on the profits that are virtually guaranteed because they're a monopoly. What these companies then do is they push the money up to the holding company. And the holding company, by using offshore vehicles of the kind I've spent years explaining, by buying tax shelters, by engaging in transactions that have no economic substance but make taxes disappear, then typically pay little or no income tax. Well, the result of that is that you're paying much higher rates than you need to pay. Typically, about 3 to 5% of your monthly bill to PG&E, for example, goes to pay federal and state income taxes. But at the parent company, if they pay little or no money, that money never gets to the government. It becomes increased profits to the company. Now, the really worst example of this, Joy, is what's happened with pipelines. The pipeline companies got a law passed in 1986 that exempts them from the corporate income tax because they are organized as what are called master limited partnerships, or MLPs. They don't pay the corporate income tax, but through the machinations of the George W. Bush administration that I describe in the book, they get to collect. In fact, they don't get to collect. They force you to pay them their corporate income tax, even though they're not obligated to pay it to the government. In California, I wrote a little short piece, and I tell about in the book, on how the SFPP pipeline, that's a remnant of the octopus from the late 1800s that was strangling the California economy, the way the railroads were strangling the economy. They were going to collect $9 million in California state income taxes for pipeline operations within California. This is an example of how citizens can make a difference. Three people who read my little short piece about this on the internet called up the California Public Utilities Commission and said, I want to appear on the public portion of the agenda when this comes up tomorrow to protest this. Well, that killed it. That's all it took. This little spotlight, 200-word article by me in a minor website, three people read it, three people called, picked up the phone and said, I'm going to do something about this, asked to be on the agenda. They were put on the agenda, and the commission killed it. It'll save people in California. You know, everybody listening, I'd saved you 25 cents a year, inflation adjusted for forever. Not much money, but, you know, also at least you got your 25 cents. It doesn't take a lot to kill many of these things as long as people know about them.
That's a story that had a happy ending. On the other hand, you talk about Entergy in Louisiana and Joe Sieber's crusade. He was an auditor who audited their bills to entities like Sam Houston State University, the New Orleans Sewer and Water Board. Tell us about that and what happened to him.
Joe has a nationwide business auditing utility bills, principally for governments, but sometimes for nonprofits like colleges and big businesses. And he only gets paid if he finds you were overcharged. And he doesn't charge anything going forward. He collects from whatever you recover for the overcharges. And he's been doing this for 30 years. And his very first customer that he worked for was a city in East Texas, and he found that energy was cheating them. So over the years, he has again and again and again proven that Entergy was cheating various governments, the state of Louisiana, the city of New Orleans, the U.S. Coast Guard, out of millions and millions of dollars by overbilling them. Well, Entergy got tired of this. And so there was a storm in Louisiana that caused a corroded old electric light pole to fall over. It hit on the head a man who ran a fruit stand in front of Charity Hospital in downtown New Orleans. He is damaged for life, and he sued Entergy and won a big judgment. Entergy then turned around and sued this auditor, and they said it was your duty to tell us, because you were hired by the city to audit electric bills, that this power pole was corroded and could fall over and hurt somebody. I mean, it's a ridiculous assertion. The judge threw the case out, but he let the company appeal, which kept it alive. So they appealed, and they just dragged their heels on the appeal to keep it there. They tried to get him to quit. He was ordered at one point, because he was acting as his own lawyer, not to communicate with the company. And he got ticked off at them one day because they were trying to not pay him money they owed him. So he wrote a letter to the chief executive of the company with a report on showing how the company had been cheating people back to, I think it was 1888, 400 pages of stuff. And buried in it was one paragraph that referred to the fruit stand case. So the company's lawyer goes to Judge Reese Kern, and while I was there, I watched this lawyer walk in and out of the judge's chambers as if it was his own office. It was just astonishing to see how tight the lawyer for the utility was with the judge. And they asked that he be jailed for 45 days because that was the appropriate punishment for having one paragraph in a 400-page document that made a passing mention of the a reference. And by the way, in the paper version of the document, they took a knife and cut it out. But in the electronic version, they failed to remove this paragraph. So it was on a CD disc. The judge is hectoring this guy, Sieber. I mean, really being tough on him. And just as he's about to pronounce that he's going to jail for 45 days, he looks out in the audience. There's one person sitting in the watching the proceedings who's not involved. And he says, "Excuse me, you, the bearded gentleman, who are you?" And I stood up and I gave him my name and said, "I'm a staff reporter for the New York Times." Boy, did the room change. The judge almost sounded neutral after that. And he took a break, and then he ordered Joe jailed for 30 days, which he reduced to 7 if he'd write a letter of apology. And they asked, "Well, can we show you the letter of apology to make sure it's okay?" And he said, "No, if I don't approve it, then you're going to jail." So they sent the letter off. The Entergy then went to the judge and said, "This isn't a proper letter of apology." They demanded he be jailed anyway, even though it's a total abject, you know, prostrating of himself in front of the company. And we go back to court, and only Joe will tell people, and so was Lloyd, the only reason Joe didn't go to jail for 45 days was the New York Times was in the courtroom watching what was going on. But this is how far companies will go, Joy, to suppress people, to make sure they worked very quietly to change these laws. They don't walk in and say, "Oh, we want to completely rewrite the code." They do it bit by bit, a little here, a little there. And then when they run into somebody they can't shut down, like Joe, well, hey, we'll just try to put you in jail. And here's the kicker to this story. It's so wonderful. Entergy has something called their integrity policy, integrity with an E, and they declare themselves to be the leader in corporate ethics in the utility industry. And one of their policies is that if anybody presents evidence of any kind of wrongdoing, you are not to push them aside. You are to treat this seriously and investigate it. So here's a guy who's brought repeated evidence that they're cheating people, and they don't even follow their own policy. And their lawyer comes to me and says, after this proceeding, "You know, you shouldn't be here writing about this." But he also says to me, "Well, we don't know how to get rid of this guy." And I looked at him and I said, gee, it's really easy to put Joe Sieber out of business. He said, it is? And I said, well, sure. You can put him out of business today, forever. He'll have no business with energy. He says, how do we do that? I said, stop cheating people.
That was a real conversation stopper.
Oh, yeah. If your business model, though, is to cheat people, and if the regulators whose job it is to make sure you are punished when you cheat people don't do their job, you can cheat. And I assure you that there are other people in the same business Joe is in. They're just not as bird dog and dogged about it, all over the country, who routinely show the utility companies are cheating you on street lights and what they build school districts and everybody else. Joe once found a federal building that had two electric meters for the same service, and they were double billing. Nobody was paying attention until he noticed it. That's how he actually started his business, when he noticed that and thought, well, I wonder what else is going on.
Well, speaking of double billing, I would like to spend the remaining time that we have with you, David K. Johnston, talking about the ways in which Congress has created laws that actually require big corporations to profit now and pay taxes later.
Yep.
Give us a shot at that.
Well, Warren Buffett, who I read a lot about in the book and how he profits off of his monopolies and his tax practices, Warren Buffett has an interest-free loan from you and me as taxpayers that the last time I looked, he has to make a disclosure about it every year, was more than two-thirds of $1 billion, and he only had to pay half of it back in 34 years. So imagine this if you're listening to the show. Imagine that you, or if you're younger, your parents, bought a house 34 years ago in 1978 at 1978 prices. And you lived in it all these years until today without ever making a payment on the house. And today you've got to pay half the number of dollars you agreed to in 1978. Now, I bought a house in 1978 for a little over $100,000. So I would today owe $50,000, even though those dollars are worth 40 cents each. Imagine how rich you'd be if you didn't have a mortgage payment for those 34 years. Well, that's what Buffett and all these other businesses do. They borrow from the government because Congress has rules that say you must pay your taxes on the following schedules. And this is why the tax code is so big. The tax code isn't big because of you and me. When it comes to wage earners, the government is efficient, effective. It takes the money out of your check before you get paid. But for business, there are all these rules that allow them to delay recognizing income for tax purposes. So you earn a profit today, but you don't have to tell the government you earned the profit for 10, 20, 30 years. If you're the manager of a private equity firm like Bain Capital, which was the sole property of Mitt Romney until 2002, you can defer 100% of your income. If you're John Simon, the big hedge fund manager who made $4 billion one year and $5 billion the next, he made $9 billion for himself in 2 years, you don't have to pay any taxes on that money as long as you keep your hedge fund open. So, you know, if you're in your 30s, you could keep that fund open nominally until you're in your 80s. You could delay the taxes for 50 years, and then you're assuming that the government actually will go and check up on you at that time. And in the meantime, you borrow against these assets and live tax-free. Well, corporations do this by essentially borrowing money. They have a liability to the government they don't have to pay, and they're getting what amounts to an interest-free loan. And it's an enormous amount of money. And everything that they can possibly do to enhance this, they do. That's why in 2010, corporate income taxes equaled 1.2% of the American economy. Now think about that. The dominant institution in American life is corporations. The 14,000 biggest companies own 90% of the business assets in America, 90%. The 2,600 biggest companies own over 60% of the business assets in America. They are incredibly, fantastically giant organizations. And yet, they paid this tiny, tiny amount of tax. And if you look at incomes, individual incomes, for everybody, the total income earned by people for their work, and corporate profits, individual incomes are flat. The bottom 90% of Americans today have a lower income than they did in 1966. 1966, when you adjust for inflation. Average income, bottom 90% of Americans, was higher in 1966 than it is today. It was actually higher in 1967. It's the same in 1966. But corporations are earning record profits. And here's the two sweetest deals that they've gotten. In 19 states, California is not yet one of them, but it will be. In 19 states, companies are allowed to keep the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks. You heard me right. They get to keep the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks, and they don't turn it over to the state. And the workers don't even know about it because they've had the taxes withheld. They're treated as having paid the taxes. The companies just file what's called a tax credit form, and then they don't have to turn the money over to the government. And this is spreading everywhere like wildfire. The second deal they got came from Ronald Reagan. In 1986, Reagan signed a law, which nobody in the news media wrote about at the time, that undid a law that's been on the books since 1909. Since 1909, if you own a business, you are not allowed to build up unlimited amounts of cash in that business. And there are thousands of cases the IRS has brought against people who, you know, somebody bought a McDonald's that turned out to be on the best street corner in town, so they're suddenly minting money hand over fist. And if they don't pay it out to themselves as a profit, take it as wages, or invest it in buying a new business, the IRS would slap them with a 15% penalty tax. So they had to pay the corporate income tax, and they had to pay the 15% on top. In 1986, Reagan signed a law that said this doesn't apply if you build up these profits offshore. So what have multinational companies done since then? They put all their intellectual property offshore. Every time Pfizer sells a Viagra tablet, the profits become a tax deduction in the U.S. They're not a profit in the U.S., they're a tax deduction, a royalty payment for the use of the chemical formula to make Viagra pills is paid by Pfizer U.S. to Pfizer Switzerland. The money accumulates untaxed in Europe. And now American corporations are sitting on over $3 trillion of untaxed profits offshore. And overall, American corporations have $6 trillion of cash. That's almost $20,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. And about half that money is never money that's never been taxed. Want to know why you don't have a job? Want to know why companies say they don't have any money to invest? It's because they don't want to pay the taxes on that money, and to reinvest it, they'd have to pay them. So what's the new plan being proposed by some of the Republicans running for Congress this year that they promised to implement if they get control? Bring back your profits offshore and don't pay any tax on them. And if you build a factory or create jobs, you can deduct 100% of that $1 billion immediately. So think about that. You got a $350 million tax deduction for every $1 billion when you took the money out of the country. Now you bring it back, we're going to give you another $350 million tax deduction. You now own a $1 billion factory, and you only put $300 million into it.
But David K. Johnston, isn't that what the Jobs Creation Act of 2004 did?
That's what it was promised to do, but in fact, the Jobs Creation Act did not require one to create any jobs. And Pfizer, the biggest beneficiary, they brought back $37 billion and saved $11 billion in taxes. Pfizer then fired 40,000 workers. Just one company, Pfizer, after that Jobs Creation Act was passed, fired 40,000 people. The proponents of that law said that it would create 660,000 jobs. So I called the economist who did the work, and he said, well, it turns out our model didn't work. And now they want a permission to bring back what's been estimated officially by Congress to be $1.4 trillion. I think it'll probably be closer to $2 trillion because they'll keep some of the untaxed money offshore. And if they bring it back, bring back $2 trillion, the tax deduction for that they'll get if they immediately reinvest that money will equal all the income taxes every worker in America will pay next year from January until sometime around the end of September.
I wonder, you reported in the spring before the primaries were done, Mitt and Ann Romney being able to give $100 million to their children tax-free. Can you briefly explain about carried interest and how that works?
Well, this isn't a carried interest story. In this case, there's a gift tax. put in place by the Republicans in 1924 to make sure rich people didn't rent out the tax status of their poorer relatives to escape paying income taxes. And in 1996, when the Romneys created the trust for their five sons, you could only put in, a married couple, $1.2 million. And above that, you had to pay a gift tax. And on $100 million, the gift tax would have come to more than $40 million. The Romneys have acknowledged in writing, in response to my question, that no gift tax was paid. How did they do that? Well, they created a little company at Bain Capital that was going to run something called DoubleClick. But at the time they set it up, it had no business, had nothing going on, it had no value. They put the stock into the son's trust. Then, in a few months, they put DoubleClick into play. They made this enormous fortune, and the money passed untaxed to benefit their sons. And rich people do this all the time. Romney is not unique about that. If you're an ordinary American, you'll be told you can only give $13,000 a year to your children, each child, if you have enough money to do that. But if you're very rich, you can do things like this. The income tax system is not as it appears. The carried interest thing you raised is this. If you're an investor and you put your money that you've saved at risk in an investment, and there's a profit or a dividend, you pay 15% of that profit to the government. Romney and other managers of funds who don't have their own money in it, they're managing other people's funds. They get to pay on their share of the profits the same interest rate, the same tax rate of 15%. They should be taxed at wage rates because they're executives managing the company. And so they should be paying 35%. Instead, they pay 15%, and when they choose to, they pay zero by deferring into the future. And when they need money, they just borrow against these untaxed assets that are offshore. And if you've got a billion-dollar fortune offshore and you go to your banker and say, hey, I want to borrow $10 million, they're happy to do it. And at the end of the year, you don't pay back the $10 million. You say, now I'm worth $1.1 billion. I want to borrow another $10 million. They write you a new note for $20 million, including the interest, plus the interest you owe from the first year. And you get richer and richer over time and never pay taxes because the borrowing interest rate is lower than the tax rate.
David K. Johnson, I'm so sorry, but we're over time. You have another show to do in about 3 minutes. We thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio and for writing the incredible books and doing the work that you do.
Well,
the
thank
fine
you, Joy.
Print,
thank
how
you very
big
much.
Companies use plain English to rob you blind. We barely scratch the surface of what's in there today. Thank you so much. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Our stalwart engineer is Ann Newport. I'm Joy LeClaire. Forthright Radio is made possible with a grant from the Allison Alfred Adler Memorial Trust with assistance from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. And you can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com.